Good afternoon. I'm Alan Ault, and I'm a friend of AA, and I serve as a non-alcoholic trustee on the General Service Board. We have some paid announcements first. I'm to remind the attendees that the special needs seating sections, anybody know where those are? They're right over there. And they are reserved exclusively for those who are in some way handicapped. I think I would have written that a little differently, but... Well, they're going to lock us in, and being an old warden and corrections director, I'm very used to that. And they might even let us out again. I would like to start with a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the past 70 years. Over the past several years, have had quite a bit to do with the courts as a receiver. I was a warden of a maximum security prison in which some 7,000 new inmates came through a year that had just been convicted by our friends, the judges. And then I was the director of corrections for 5 governors in 3 states. And my last real job, I had 38,000 inmates and 75,000 probationers. And then I joined the Justice Department. That's not a real job. I just had a position there. And now I've retired to become a dean of a college, which I finally decided what I do when I grow up. We have 3 speakers who truly know what they're talking about. And they're Bill T. from Michigan. Superior Court Judge Rogelio Flores from San Diego, California. And in that place I work for the Justice Department, we have Karen Freeman Wilson, National Drug Court Institute in Virginia. Each of our speakers will present for about 20 minutes, and then we'll hold our questions till each have presented, and then you have the floor to yourself, and you can have at them. Bill, would you like to try this? They're very friendly, folks.
Hi, everyone. My name's Bill, and I am a real alcoholic. I say real alcoholic because on page 30 of our beloved big book, it states on that first sentence, most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics, and today I can freely admit that. I don't know about you, but I was nervous sitting up here with all these professional people and being the only alcoholic. But when I look out in a crowd, I really feel comfortable again. It's like more of us than them, so. You know, in the old days, I would have sort of tried to blend into the walls and been a wallflower so they couldn't see me. But I'm actually sitting up next to them and not sweating. You know, that's a miracle of the program. You know, a little story about myself to show that I do qualify. I was incarcerated at Jackson State Prison in Michigan for 14 months. I spent time in the Florida State Prison in Southern Florida. Spent a little over a year at Louisiana State Prison. Spent some time in the federal prison in Fort Worth, Texas. Spent time in the Wayne County Jail, Oakland County Jail, Macomb County Jail.
You didn't lose the job, didn't you?
Yeah. I was a guest to a lot of governors. You know, the amazing part is I've never been incarcerated except to carry the message since April 10th, 1991, the day I walked in. So when Doug said I was qualified to be on his panel, I couldn't figure out why. But I did come through the court systems, number one. So The lady that handled my case, probation officer, was Susan O'Shea, and I'll never forget her, because she saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And she kept on me. Even when I was done with probation, she continued to call my house to make sure I was okay and sober. And that means a lot is for people to care that are friends of AA. And she gave me encouragement to continue on and keep working with the program. And I ended up getting a good sponsor, got involved with AA. After about a year in it, one of my service positions was making a mistake of going to the area assembly meeting during elections and getting voted for correctional chair for Southeastern Michigan. The mistake I made is I went to the restroom when elections were going on. And being egotistical, when I finally realized what they did to me, my sponsor was there, and I told him how, man, they elect to make correctional chair. And he burst that bubble immediately, telling me, Bill, you were their sixth choice. The other five guys turned it down. God has a way of doing that to me today in my life. So I did get involved with correctional. I tried to get back into the facilities, but can you believe they kept me locked out? But I had a passion for it because I seen people dying inside. And I stayed with it. Instead of going in, I started carrying the message to groups outside that we needed volunteers, we needed help. And our committee grew from 10 people up to close to 200, 250 people. From there, I went on to be statewide correctional chair for the state of Michigan. And then once I rotated out of that, I started getting involved with the court systems itself. One of the things I got involved with, well, let me back up a little bit and tell you the miracle that happens with this program, because I'm so proud of it also. I had about 3 years of sobriety working with correctional center, and I finally was making my amends. And I made all my monetary amends because the program blessed me with my own business and everything. But my emotional amends were hard. And one of my emotional amends was to my two sons. And it took me 3 years in the program to get to that point of making it. But through the grace of this program, it worked. And where I made it to them was on a toll road, taking a trip with my two sons, 12 and 17 years old. And for me, that was a perfect place and time to make it because we could not run away from each other. And that's what I did all my life. I ran away like a con. I ran away. I couldn't face people. And I made it on the road to them, and there was a lot of silence, a lot of angry words, a lot of tears, but they were made. And along the way, I had to stop and get gas and that, and I seen a pot machine and started walking over the pot machine. My 12-year-old son started walking over with me, and I reached in my pocket for my change and pulled out my 3-year token. And my son, Billy, who was named after me, seen it, and he asked what it was. And I told him for my anniversary, and he couldn't figure out anniversary for what. I'm not married. So I handed it to him, and he started looking at it, and he seen Bill Wilson and Bob Smith on the face of the coin. He asked who they were, and I explained who they were, how they founded this wonderful fellowship I belong to that keeps me sober one day at a time. And he asked me, Dad, can I keep this to remind me of the two guys that gave my dad back to me? This is what he's done for me. I think that's why I got to keep giving back, because so much was given to me. So I work with the courts, I work with the judges, I work with the prisons. One of the programs I work with is, we call it First Offenders Program, and it's people that aren't sure they're alcoholics, but they're locked up. Go figure. We never thought that way, did we? So here they're locked up, and the procedures of this program is to give them a taste, just a slight taste of what it's going to be like. They keep them locked up for the weekend. They do a thorough strip search. They take them into the psych ward of the jail just to give them a taste of some of the inmates they may be bunking with. They hear programs. They hear talks from us, from Alcoholics Anonymous. They hear talks from different people involved with alcoholism. One of the good people that speak is one of the deputy sheriffs that actually tell them, people, I used to drink too, but you people made the laws. I didn't. I just got to enforce them. And when you made the laws, I quit drinking. But I'm guaranteed any night of the week to sit out in front of any of the bars in this county and pick one of you up. That's a guarantee. It's guaranteed. And some people still don't get the message. And then I have the opportunity to go in there and tell them my story, share my story, that they don't have to go through what I went through. Prison after prison, jail after jail. You don't have to keep repeating this. Relapse is a requirement. We do have the chance to work with the judges, and it's a great opportunity. When I come in the program, I thought it was something new, but I'm pretty much of a history buff of AA, too, and I go back in a lot of the history and found out we're not inventing anything new. This has been going on since the early 50s working with these judges. a great opportunity, great friends. But what happens, I think, is we're celebrating our 70th anniversary, and we as alcoholics just assume everybody on the outside knows about us. You know, and they don't. And it's our responsibilities as members to carry the message to them, to explain what we are. No matter how much schooling they do, how many books they read, they don't understand what we are. You know, we have a hard time understanding who we are. You know, and it's our responsibility. We are responsible to carry this message to the people, on, not only on the inside, but on the outside. Explain to them over and over again the illness we have. And take responsibility for the people still to come. You know, to go to these meetings, not to complain every time, oh, man, I gotta go. I'm the only one going into this lockup. I'm the only one going to see this, doing a 12-step call. Oh, it's too far for me to go. You know, thank God the guy that took over as my sponsor when I walked through the doors, if he had that attitude, you know, tell him where I would be today. You know, maybe I do know where I'd be. With the record I had, I'd be locked up somewhere, probably permanently. You know, we have an opportunity here to work with the judges and try to teach them what we know as best as we can. And we'll never fully learn how we do it. Nobody ever does. But we have the opportunity to work with the professional community, especially the judges, and get the people as they're coming in here directly and taking responsibility for the people that the judges sent to us. I think that's all I have today to share here. Thanks, Alan.
Good afternoon. My name is Rogelio, and I'm a friend of AA. I've been a judicial officer now for 18 years, working on my 19th year. And as young as I look, I must have been in kindergarten when they appointed me to the bench. 18 years, and I can tell you, in the past 18 years, I must have had 60,000 people pass through my courts. And out of 60,000 people, I must have sent at least 10,000 to AA or NA meetings. I must refer family members to Al-Anon. And I can tell you that nothing I do, and the work that I do as a judicial officer, would be impossible without the fantastic work of AA. And just being here today has been an honor and a privilege, and I am truly humbled. Now, humility and judges are two words that usually don't go together. I come from not from San Diego, although I love San Diego. I come from Santa Maria, California, which is in Santa Barbara County. And you might have heard of Santa Maria. This is where Michael Jackson's trial just resolved. It was in our court complex. No, almost. And it was kind of refreshing when all the media trucks pulled out and we got our parking spots back. Santa Maria is an agricultural community. We grow strawberries and broccoli and of course, wine grapes. And that's the big industry now. You know, everybody's into this stuff. And one of the things that occurred is 18 years ago when I was appointed, I was the first Latino, first Hispanic appointed to the bench in our community. And that came with a lot of strings. Because now everywhere I am in the community, I'm looked at by young Hispanics, young Latinos as a role model. But 18 years ago when I was appointed to the bench, it's really went to my head. We had a big enrolling ceremony about this many people in the room, and the trappings that come along with being a judge, they sit you up higher, and then, you know, they give you a bailiff, they give you a robe, they give you these flags and all this pomp and circumstance. And so that night, after being sworn in, I'm driving home with my wife, and I said, you know, honey, what do you think? You're married to the first Latino judge from Santa Maria. And my wife didn't say anything. That night we went to bed, and I said, tonight you're sleeping with the first Latino judge from Santa Maria. Again, she didn't respond. The next morning, it was a beautiful January morning in Santa Maria. I said, how do you feel waking up next to the first Latino judge in Santa Maria? She said, you know, sweetheart, let me take you to breakfast. I said, great. She said, I'll drive. So we get in the car, and she drives down the street, and I roll down the windows, and I said, what a great day to be with the first Latino judge in Santa Maria. She pulls the car into Rosemary Farms, which is a chicken ranch in Santa Maria, chickens with an egg ranch. And there are thousands of chickens in these chicken coops that are about 4 feet off the ground. And there underneath one of the chicken coops was a young man scooping droppings up into a plastic bucket. A young man, he's about my age. And she said, honey, you see that guy over there? I said, yeah. My wife said, that used to be my boyfriend. And I said, well, him. But you're married to the first Latino judge in Santa Maria. And she said, if I would have married him, he would have been the first Latino judge. Now, I've told this story repeatedly over the past 18 years. People ask me if it's true or not, and whether it's true or not is not important. Certainly the message that it conveys is true, that none of us are here because of our own exploits, but we're here because of the people who have loved us and supported us and gotten us where we are today. And for that, I'm thankful. I'm thankful to God, and I'm thankful to my wife and my family for being so supportive. And I'm also thankful for the thousands of people who have passed in my court. You know, my life as a judge in the past 18 years has been one epiphany, one little eye-opening experience after another, much like the Apostle Paul when he was blinded by his own arrogance and the scales fell from his eyes. There are things that happened in my life as a judge that have opened my eyes repeatedly. And let me share a few of those with you and how they relate to AA and court programs. First and foremost, early on in my judicial career, I was assigned to the DUI calendar. And I had a young man, 19 years old, charged with a first offense drunk driving. Now, in California, as most jurisdictions, a first offense DUI carries pretty much a slap on the wrist. You get placed on probation, you lose your license for a while, and there's no jail time. In our courts, we were able to see what the blood alcohol content was on the cover of the complaint filed by the district attorney. His blood alcohol content was 0.46. 19 years old, 0.46, we can only imagine when this young man started drinking. So he came into my court, and I remanded him into custody, off the arraignment calendar. And I remanded him to custody. He pled guilty. I remanded him to custody, and I ordered him to serve 30 days in jail forthwith, and I ordered him into a six-month rehab program where he was by the time he was done, apparently he was sponsoring, he attended hundreds of AA meetings. Fast forward now, several months, and I'm on the bench. And this young man approaches my bailiff, Gary, and he said, I'd like to speak to the judge. And I said, Gary said, sure, because my bailiff knows that I encourage people to come and talk to me. That's part of the humility, the lesson we learned, that I have to be able to know that we're doing something in the community that I serve. So he approached the bench and said, judge, do you remember me? I said, no, I don't. You know, I call 4,000 or 5,000 cases a year. There's no way to remember everybody. He said, I was the young man that was here, and I had a 0.46 blood alcohol content. I said, well, yeah, of course I remember you. I remember. He said, I came here today because today's my first year of sobriety, and I came here to thank you. I didn't realize that we could do good things for the bench. I mean, I took this job because I thought we could do good things, but I had no idea the impact that you can have in being proactive for one individual in one case at a time. I met him that time, and I met him after his fifth year of sobriety. He came to see me again. And he's now married. He's got three kids. He's got a job. And I thank God because that was an introduction for me, even though alcoholics in the florist family tree, they're everywhere. Okay, so none of us are immune. And so I can tell you that it's really important for a judicial officer to remember that we can do good works. We can do good works as long as we know that I'm pushing people out there and there's somebody to receive them and somebody to share the good news with them. I can also tell you the story about the domestic violence and how it impacts in alcoholics. I mean, here I am preaching to the choir. But I can tell you, let's call them for the sake of anonymity, Frankie and Johnny, and this is a true story. Most of the things I'm going to tell you are true. The 19-year-old was true. The chicken ranch, I don't know. Anyway. Early on in my judicial career and calling the criminal arraignment calendar, Frankie and Johnny, husband and wife, both would go out and get drunk, and they'd beat each other up. Frankie would go to the bars. Johnny would find her there. Take her home, beat her up. Johnny would go to the bars. Frankie would finally go home. And this is going on and on. They've got children. And in most people's minds' eyes, not only the courts, but probation, law enforcement, you name it, we would say things like, these two people deserve each other. Mm-hmm. They deserve each other. What insanity is that? Finally, for months, I had not seen either one of them. And I parked the corner of my car in the parking lot. And I'm walking up to my courtroom, and Frankie jumps out and says, judge, yeah, Frankie, how you doing? She goes, I'm doing great. I'm involved with AA. I've got a sponsor. I've been clean for 6 months. And I have a court hearing this afternoon in the civil department. I know you're a criminal judge, but in the civil department, I have a court hearing today. And I was wondering if you would come and testify for me that I'm a good mom, that you knew me when I was going nuts, and you're here to speak for me. I said, Frankie, I would love to do that, but one judge cannot testify in a case for another person. I'd love to speak for you. I'm very happy for you. But good luck, and I hope I hope you prevail because you are a good person. She says, I figured you couldn't go anyway, but she gave me a hug there in the parking lot. That's the first time I'd hugged a defendant. K Karen, our next speaker, is going to talk. She knows all about drug court judges. Now we just hug everybody. We hug trees. We hug, you know. In California, you hug a lot of trees. Okay. So I hugged Frankie, and then I went back to work, and I was really happy. I said, man, what a great thing. She's found sobriety, 6 months clean and sober. She looks great. You know, she doesn't look all worn down and beat up. And hopefully she gets her kids back. 10 days later, she was dead. Her husband shot her and killed her. And so that was about 12 years ago. And 12 years ago, Frankie asked me to speak for her. And I told her I couldn't do it, but I'm speaking for her today. And my work as a judge, in terms of court programs, is dedicated to try to prevent the 19-year-old from wrapping his car around a tree and the young woman with children whose husband is now serving life in prison, two children left orphans, and all the misery and pain that alcohol causes in our society, and try to prevent that and use the power of the bench as a method of healing communities, as a method of solving problems, as a method of listening. And so I tell you, when I said, first off, that I'm a friend of AA, so much so that I have an open door policy that people from the AA community want to come and talk to me. They just come in and talk. They come in just like the 19-year-old did and say, hey, I need to talk to the judge. You know, Judge Flores, you're sending people to 12-step meetings, you're sending people to AA meetings, and they're not paying for the coffee. And so my next speech, when I got a courtroom full of defense, by the way, if I hear that you're going to a meeting and not paying for coffee, I'm going to put you in jail. I've sent thousands of people to AA, and sometimes the people in the AA community come and say, Judge, you know, these folks don't want to be here. They don't want to be here. Doggone it. You know, they come, and they're not committed like us. You know, we're real alcoholics. And I tell them, look, I remember when I was a kid, my hair was out of my shoulders, used to work a ponytail. And I dreaded going to the barber. But my dad kept sending me to the barber shop, and eventually I got my hair cut. And I'm going to send these folks to the barber shop over and over again until finally someone's going to get their doggone hair cut. And it's worked for some people. It hasn't worked for all. But that's the collaboration we need. You know, the courts cannot function in a vacuum. We need AA. We need you and your expertise and wisdom. We need your knowledge and your passion. We need you because you are in the front lines of this horrible and tragic battle that we're fighting. But I'm convinced, after walking around here, my first international convention, that doggone it, we got some soldiers out there. You guys are pretty awesome. So for the past 5 years, full time, I've been working in a drug court. You're going to hear more about that in just a minute. But I have 600 recovering addicts in my court, you know, and it is the best work I've ever done. I go to home every night and I'm smiling because, you know, I feel if we've saved one, we've done a heck of a job. We're saving hundreds. And I like to tell the people in my court that we're changing the face of Santa Maria, one addict and one alcoholic at a time, one day at a time, because the work is immense. I spoke earlier this morning in Spanish, the Spanish-speaking group, about this work. And I told them then, and I'll tell you now, that, you know, it was difficult to pack up my stuff and fly. You know, I'm still on West Coast time, and I'm all like, how many of you from California? Yeah, okay, you know what I'm talking. You guys are tired, huh? You know what time it is? But I do this because I come to these meetings and conferences, and I meet people, and I get energized. I'm on fire. I want to go back, you know, and I want to share your passion, and I want to share your vision and your wisdom, and I want to share your lives with the people I work with and tell people there is hope. This is a fatal disease that we can cure. This is failed one day at a time. There's no miracles out there. This is a lot of hard work, and you're the hardest workers I've ever met in my life. I want to thank you. I want to thank you for inviting me, for giving me a chance to share a few words with you. And I look forward to meeting all of you. Of course, it's not going to be possible, but I love all of you, and I love what you do, and I love what you stand for, and I love AA. Thank you very much, and God bless.
Join me at the podium.
have warmed up for you?
They're all yours.
Thanks, my wife. My name is Karen, and I'm a friend of AA. I can't tell you what an honor and a privilege it is to be here today. A couple of weeks ago, Judge Flores and I were at a meeting, and I was fortunate enough to preside over that meeting, of drug court professionals down in Orlando, Florida. And we thought it was a very big meeting. There were 2,400 people in attendance. And during that meeting, we said happy birthday and acknowledged the anniversary of AA. It is my honor to tell you happy birthday in person. And now I know what a big meeting really looks like. We all come to our experiences, be they professional or personal, with what we have experienced in life. And so I want to share a little bit of mine with you, because long before I was in Washington at the National Drug Court Institute, long before I was on the bench in Gary, Indiana, long before I went to law school or college or even high school, I was very, very familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, my mother's brother, my Uncle Pete, my favorite uncle, lived with us. And for over 30 years, or at least 30 years through my recollection, he fought a battle with alcohol. He lived with us. And I remember times, in fact, one time vividly stands out in my mind, when I decided as a kid that I would help him fight, because a lot of times I would stay home with him in the summer. And Uncle Pete was on one of his drunks and was in his room, and I decided that I was going to prevent him from getting anything else. And so I locked Uncle Pete in the house. Now, how many of you know he had two or three bottles under his bed? And but Uncle Pete lived ultimately to be 68 years old. And one of the reasons that he lived as long as he did, and ultimately he succumbed to alcohol poisoning, he was a brittle diabetic. But in between the time that I locked him in the house and the time that he passed was at least 11 years of sobriety that I am sure prolonged his life, and that was a direct result of his active involvement in AA. That informed me when I got to the court in Gary, Indiana. And shortly after getting on the bench in 1996, there was something that became very clear to me. I would see the same people over and over again. And I knew that as much as I thought my judicial demeanor was, and as great as I thought it was, they weren't there because they were happy to see me. Whether it was Eddie or Joe or Jane or Bob.
How about Bill?
Or Bill. Although Bill never made it to Indiana. Whoever they were there because they were suffering with the disease. And I had the opportunity early on to go to San Bernardino, California. And right before I went there, a lady came to me and said, you know, I want you to think about a drug court, a specialty court. And I know you haven't seen one, but someone told me that you're going to San Bernardino, so I want you to stop there and look at that court. And you know that my husband was real pleased when we arrived to California on our family vacation, and I tell him, dear, I'm going to go down the street to the court, and I'm just going to be an hour. And I'll be back, and we can go to Disneyland and to the water parks and Raging Waters, for those of you who are from California, and all the other places that we have on our plans, in our plans to go. And he rolled his eyes and looked at me, and knew that he'd probably see me, if he was lucky, sometimes much later that day. And he did, 4 hours later. But what I had the opportunity to see changed my life, because I had the opportunity to see a court doing something that I had never seen a court do, and that is to play a role in helping individuals get their lives back. And person after person would come before the judge in the court, and the judge would say, "How are you doing? And you've done real well this week, and I'm so proud of you, and here's a token, or here's a gift certificate, or here's a coupon so you can get your family some groceries." And I heard a judge say, "I'm really concerned because you're not making progress this week. What can I do to help you? I'm going to sanction you, or I'm going to do something else to encourage you, because we know that you can make it." And I heard a judge say, "I know you want to quit this program, but I'm not going to let you go until you succeed, because I know you can do it. And we're going to walk this walk with you." And when I got back to Gary, my co-workers at the court thought I was possessed. Well, they knew before I left, but they were convinced when I got back. And because I said, "We have to have this court in Gary." And we got one. And when we got our court, week after week, month after month, year after year, I was privileged to do like that judge that I saw in California did, in helping people and just being an instrument used by God to help people get their lives back. And that court was drug court. And that's what I do today. Well, what's a drug court? How many of you have ever been in drug court? A drug court is a different docket. It is a specialty docket where we understand that individuals suffer from the disease of addiction to alcohol and other drugs. We understand that just because we're wearing a robe and sitting a little higher than everyone else, and have a gavel, and have a bailiff, that just because I say stop drinking doesn't mean that folks are going to stop drinking. That just because I say stop drinking and driving doesn't mean that somebody's going to say, "Okay, Your Honor," to me or Judge Flores, and stop doing it. And so it combines treatment with testing, drug testing, alcohol testing. Sometimes they're in ignition interlock devices or ankle bracelets. It combines a team embracing an individual who wants to do better, that team being the prosecutor, the public defender. And get this, in drug court, guess what? The prosecutor and the public defender, they don't argue. They don't fight. They get along. Because in drug court, everybody loves each other. And together, this team that includes probation and law enforcement and the judge and treatment, we all work together with the person who's charged with the offense, everything from theft to DWI to many other offenses, to help a person get on the road to recovery. At the exception, the first drug court was established in Florida in 1989. Here's a piece of trivia if you ever get on Jeopardy or something. The first drug court prosecutor in Florida was Janet Reno. Heard somebody say it over there. And she took that philosophy to Washington when she became our U.S. Attorney General in 1994. When Janet Reno went to Washington, there were less than 50 drug courts. Today, there are over 1,600. By the end of this year, we expect there to be 2,000. But at the inception of drug court, when they planned what drug court clients would have to do, they talked about treatment. They talked about community service. They talked about paying fines and costs. But at the top of the list, because we understood that drug court was just the beginning of a long road to recovery was Alcoholics Anonymous, AA. So every drug court participant, whether they're in Maine or California, whether they're in Washington State or Florida, whether they're in Canada or Ireland or Australia, has to, as a condition of their program participation and completion, participate in AA. Now, I know that there's some of you out there who rue the day that drug courts were started and think, why are you sending them to us, as George Flores said? And there's some who think, you know what? If they don't want to be here, they shouldn't have to. But I'm here to tell you, not just because the research says it, because I've seen it day after day all over this country, that coercion works. And just because, and it's not just coercion because we're judges. It's coercion from your wife, from your husband, from your children, from your parents, from your employers. We're just using a different form of coercion. And we happen to have the ability to use jail with our form of coercion. So, you can say it, and I know you get tired of some of our folks, but coercion works. In closing, let me tell you this. There are many forms of drug courts. There are adult drug courts. There are juvenile drug courts. There are healing to wellness drug courts. There are DWI drug courts. In fact, those are the fastest growing among the drug courts. And there are family dependency drug courts for parents who are accused of abusing or neglecting their children. We have a powerful, powerful partnership. In hindsight, in 1989, when the first court was started, it would have been helpful for us to consult with our friends and our colleagues at AA and say, we're going to send you some people who may be a little difficult in the beginning, but we're going to work with you to make sure that they succeed in the end. I can tell you that I have been a professional vagabond. Done some great things. Wonderful things, fun, challenging, been a public defender, prosecutor, been a judge, been attorney general of the state, but by far, without a doubt, without a question, the most rewarding thing that I've done is to work on behalf and in support and in promotion of drug courts, because every day, no matter where I go, and I've been blessed to go many places, I see somebody who's helped, who's assisted, who supported in getting their life back, either in or out of the drug court movement. Thank you for what you do to support what we do, because it is without a doubt, without AA, without NA, we would not have seen the success that we've seen with the growth of drug courts. God bless you.
Give one more hand.
Well, now it's your turn. If you have any questions for our panelists, or if you want to share, back here first. I think you had your hand up first.
You know, some courts do and some courts don't. What we have been encouraging courts to do in our training is to get with local AA fellowships and get the information so that we can then disseminate it. You know, historically what we've gotten is a list of meetings. But I think we really need to equip people with more than a list of meetings, but to equip them with the do's and don'ts, with the fact sheets, with the information so that they will know what to expect, and what is expected from them as members of the fellowship.
And as in response to your question, that's one of the reasons why I enjoy coming to this is because I need to learn. In case the dialogue between me and the local AA community is not as effective as it should be, and effective on Tuesday because Monday is America Day. Happy Canada Day for all my Canadian brothers and sisters, by the way. So, but effective Tuesday, in all our courts in Santa Maria, we're going to hand out the do's and don'ts and rules in Santa Maria. That's going to happen. And there's no reason why it shouldn't. It's a piece of cake. We got a copy machine. I hope it's, I know it's copyrighted. Don't tell Alan. But we'll have international send us a bunch more. But, you know, that's just a great suggestion.
And then there, he's going to invite everybody to Neverland.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
So we have an alcoholic and not a California fellowship. I have two children who have a hereditary disease been in and out of Croix on various heading to self-charges over the years, and I have never once heard of drug court. My question is, how is one remanded to a drug court as opposed to a regular court? Because I have actually found myself last instance, which was a couple of weeks ago, talking to the public defender that got my child's case and telling them about treatment centers and things like that.
There are two resources in California. One is drug court, the other one is Prop 36, but I would certainly recommend drug court. The public defender that's working with your children should know about drug courts, and if they don't, then I would suggest that you ask the public defender to look into it. But if you go to the drug court website, it's NADCP.org, and if you want to see us afterwards, I'll write it down for you. Look at the website, and you should be able to find the California drug courts. El Cerrito? Okay, I'm sure Contra Costa has a drug court, but we'll look into that. All right, come see me afterwards.
We certainly appreciate the anonymity of AA and certainly understand that the court and AA, the court system and AA are not affiliated. However, we want people to be able to sustain their recovery. And while I may be able to work with folks for a year and our probation departments throughout drug courts may be able to work with them for a year, we know that they can be members of AA for a lifetime. And to the extent that we can help them to get there, then we think that we have a responsibility to do that. But we understand that we are not part of AA, and there is no affiliation.
There's a request that you come to the mic so everybody can hear your question.
Hi, my name is Beverly, and I am an alcoholic. I also had the good fortune, I think, of ever being the first judicial intern in a drug court because sobriety gave me a law degree and law school gave me the opportunity to intern. So I worked in a drug court, and I know I was the first drug court intern in Lane County, Oregon, which is one of the oldest drug courts, and I worked with Judge Larson, who's phenomenal. I just wanted to bring up a couple points of information for people. You guys did an excellent job, but as a member of AA, I have a little bit different perspective, and I wanted to start with, does anybody, a trivia question, anybody have any idea of, in history, AA's history, what the first court intervention was? Who was it? Abby Thatcher, the man who 12-stepped Bill. He was in front of the court, and it was his fellows from the Oxford group that came and testified to the judge, therefore relieving him of his commitment. And as we all know, Eddie didn't stay sober. So it wasn't the court that got Bill sober or kept Bill sober, but it was Eddie's 12-stepping of Bill because of court appearance that started AA. And as much as I protect the anonymity and as much as I want AA to be separate and have one common purpose, I am also a huge advocate for drug courts and for the work that they do. So the couple of points I wanted to make are, number one, every state by law has its own version. Many counties have their own version. Some, if you go to your drug court and you get all the way through, the charge is dropped. Others, you're going to be sentenced or you're going to be convicted no matter what. It's on your record, but if you do well, you won't have worse consequences. Secondly, drug court judges are incredible human beings. If somebody doesn't believe me or wants to get the word out more, they can do this one of two ways in most jurisdictions. You can either choose to find out about your drug court and go sit in on a drug court session, which is open to the public, and they do these wonderful things like tell the new guys they got to sit down and shut up, and then they'll arrange the files in a way where the success stories come first to motivate people. Then they'll stick in the real screw-ups who either have to be incarcerated or severely reprimanded. And by the time the new guy's coming up shaking in front of the judge, he's liable to tell on himself, or he's liable to get honest, or he's liable to say, and they have the opportunity to do this, I don't want to be in your drug court. It is better for me to go face sentencing and go to jail. So part of the point I want to get out, even though I'm here at an AA convention, is as a race of humanity, drug courts help us immensely. Would you rather take a taxpayer dollar, no matter what community you're in, and give it to somebody who's got an addiction, alcohol, substance problem, and teach them how to be a better criminal in an institution, or would you rather send them to a voluntary institution to get well? Okay?
Thank you very much.
The last thing, two more things. Alcoholics are great at saying the last thing. The next thing I wanted to bring up was a problem with the courts. I will be brief. I did a research problem, and there's a problem with the judicial system because exactly what you were talking about. The prosecutors, the defendants, and the judges are all in collaboration, and in most states that breaks the ethical code. So I spent a lot of time and did some research on that, and I think the judicial body needs to look at that. Finally, I wanted to bring up tribal drug court because that was the one thing that wasn't mentioned, because tribal drug court does phenomenal things for Native Americans. Sorry for those of you who think I went on too long. I just think that it's something that can help people. Thank you.
I'm Leon Roberts, an alcoholic. I'm a past district and area correctional facilities chairperson. You know, I really applaud the judges for your apparent concern and some of the actions that you're taking with this stuff. I have one request that, and I'll give you an example of why I ask you this, is to recognize the difference of some of the addictions, as you called it, from alcohol to drug, and to recognize the singleness of purpose for AA. And the reason being is that we have had some judges, and this is a true story, sentence some minors to a MIP, minor in possession, and it was for tobacco, and they sent them to AA. That's not appropriate, and it created a lot of conflict. Getting people that you send to AA that don't want to be there, we don't have a problem with that. Because most people don't want to be there most of the time. But anyway, that's my request, and that you would recognize that. Thank you.
Hi, my name is JP, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know about all the problems we may be having, but I have to thank you just for myself. Because 20 years ago, and by the grace of God and this fellowship, 20 years ago I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous by a loving judge in Orange County, California, who said to me, I think your problem has a lot less to do with driving after... She had keen wisdom. After 8 502s, 8 drunk driving charges, she said, I think I have the solution. And she sentenced me to 3 years of AA meetings. And I thank God for that judge. By the grace of God, on October 8th, I will be sober 20 years. And the only way I got here is... It is because of that judge I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's because of all the people in this room right here that left those doors open for somebody who did not want to be there who needed to be there and needed the help, and I thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, I'm Gary, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you very much for the work that you do. I didn't find Alcoholics Anonymous by way of the courts, but I'm thrilled, basically, that Alcoholics Anonymous is considering creating a pamphlet that will help the people you send us realize that their resentment towards AA should be directed towards you rather than towards us. And that it will disappear as they do their steps. And meanwhile, I would like to second the suggestion that came out of the back of the room from Woody that that the courts make full use of our PI and our CPC committees to, number one, in terms of CPC, allow us to help the people within your judicial structure to understand who we are and who we are not, because I have seen a wide range of very differing levels of knowledge in that area. And I'm trying to say that nicely. And also to help the people that you do send to us understand that we do indeed have a form of etiquette that tell them that we not only have steps, but that we have traditions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Greg, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a full-time public defender in Portland, Oregon. And I'm a fan of drug courts. And your comment, Judge, about this is where the prosecutors and the defense attorneys and everybody get along. Yeah, that is one place where we get along. Other courts, other rooms in the same courthouse, we don't always get along. But we can usually get along in drug court, which is good. Over the years, I've had clients who have gone through drug court and DUI intensive supervision programs, which are very similar, and they've made it. And I've had clients who have gone through and they haven't. I had one that I'd gotten to know some, and he died of a heroin overdose 2 months ago, after struggling on and off, but he just couldn't make it, So the drug courts can't get everybody clean and they can't get everybody sober, but what they can do is give people a chance, and they can give people a fighting chance to take that step. And, for some of them it doesn't work, but for a lot of them it does. And when you see the people for whom it works, what you get out of it are tax-paying citizens who are back in the mainstream of society, and they're paying taxes to help fund the drug courts in the future years. But we all have to watch it because, when it comes time to cut in the courts and in public safety and whatever, it's easiest to cut drug courts. Because when it comes down to, you cut drug courts or you cut prosecutors, nobody wants to be seen as soft on crime, as it said. And drug courts are the easy places to cut. And so if you're a fan of drug courts and if you believe they do good work, you got to write your legislators and write your congressmen and write your senators and let them know that that's what you believe. Because there's a lot of people out there now, without trying to get into other issues, in certain parts of the federal government and in a lot of state governments, who this is not really a priority anymore. And we have to watch that because it's going to be very, very easy for drug courts to just slip away into anonymity and into history, and it'd be a terrible thing to see happen. So thank you all for the work you're doing.
Thank you. One thing that I would invite all of you to do is look into see if your community has a drug court. If it does, go visit. Watch what Judge Karen did when she went into San Bernardino. So was it Pat Morris that you see? Judge Morris. And it's like a court like you've never seen before, where everybody is actually pulling on the same side, trying to get somebody clean and sober. It's an amazing thing.
My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. In our area, California, we support you largely. I would suggest that on the AA side of it, when a person comes to a meeting and has been told they must attend, don't make it that they have to attend in order to get the card signed. I have seen many people walk out with a real big resentment at AA and the court, and when that person finally reaches the point where they are down enough that they really need the program, I'd like them to feel good about coming back. Thank you.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Ulrika. I'm from just outside Toronto. I'm a defense counsel. And I know that I'm one of a few, maybe three or four defense counsel in the greater Toronto area, but who are in AA. There's a lot of others who should be. To the best of my knowledge, we only have one drug court here in Ontario. It's at Old City Hall here in downtown Toronto. It was actually started by a prosecutor, one of the drug prosecutors. Obviously, Your Honor is familiar with who I'm speaking of, and that judge is now sitting in the jurisdiction that I practice in. What we don't have is a public defender system, and I say this with all due respect to the U.S. public defender system. Thank God we don't have a public defender system here. We have an entirely different. We have legal aid, and we have certificate system, and we have private defense counsel. So I guess my question to you is, first of all, just to share a bit of information about what's happening here in Canada or in Ontario that I know of. I suspect that in Oshawa, where I practice, we will be getting a drug court in the near future. It's probably the crack cocaine capital of North America at this point. You work with the public defenders, but do you also have private defense counsel? I mean, with a public defender system, it's a whole different ballgame than what we have here. Because I think that's what needs to happen here is that defense, because we have what's called duty counsel, but they don't handle trials. They just have a person that day in court only to do adjournments or a guilty plea. So that we need to get the defense counsel involved in it. And do you have that there? In what way, beyond the public defenders being involved?
Yes, absolutely. And it differs depending on where you are in terms of the degree of involvement of defense counsel. But what we train our courts to do is to really communicate with the local bar in addition to the office of the public defender. And I think what you'll find in most courts is more like your duty counsel, because what they do, because it's important to get folks involved and engaged in treatment very quickly, they will have a public defender explain what the program is so that a person's rights are protected, because there are contracts that have to be signed and drug testing that has to be done. But when you have a person come in as with private counsel or with a private attorney, they are also given an opportunity and encouraged to get involved. But a lot of times the concept is, if you have a private attorney, and I was a private attorney much longer than I defended or prosecuted, when I'm really doing well for my client is when I get them off. And that typically means when I minimize their contact with the court. And so very often that does not mean drug court, but what we're doing now, we've just did a publication that was directed at defense counsel, not just public defenders, but all defense counsel. But we're also trying to get them to understand is sometimes, and in many instances, you do your client much more good if you get them into treatment if you find they have a problem.
Thank you. Yeah, and that's one of the problems. There's always that tension that I have between being defense counsel and being an alcoholic and wanting to get them into treatment. Perhaps I'll talk to you after the meeting.
Oh, I tell you, one of the odd things about being a drug court judge is something I've never gotten used to, but sometimes we're talking about a case and the defense attorney will say, you know, judge, I think my client needs to go into custody for a couple of days. This person's not listening. And the DA says, no, why don't we leave him out of jail for a while? And I'm scratching my head. What?
That defense counsel must be in the program or
know something.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. And if you've never been to a drug court, the neatest thing is watching the judge call bullshit on the people as they talk. But the one thing that we're a little bit concerned with in our area, and I guess I'm not concerned with it, but a lot of people are, we feel like drug addicts are being sent to Alcoholics Anonymous as opposed to Narcotics Anonymous. And we recognize... We do recognize that in some areas that Narcotics Anonymous is not very strong, and if you try to send people there, they may not find it. So we do recognize that, but we wanted to make sure that that is something that people, that the judges are thinking about.
Well, my name is Richard T., and I'm an alcoholic. I have two questions. One I'll ask in the beginning and one at the end, and in between I just want to introduce myself. The question at first is, before this meeting ends and everybody mobs you guys, would you please save me a business card so I can get in touch with you, all of you? I am a credentialed counselor of the state of New York. I've been to prison in my youth. I'm a substitute school teacher. I've invented an alcohol drug addiction recovery board game. They use it at Harlem Hospital, many other hospitals, and treatment agencies. And my second question is, would you guys consider sentencing inmates to play my board game?
Oh,
Do you have any board games?
I'll get some. My name is Linda, and I'm an alcoholic from Atlanta, Georgia. And I am a very big fan of your court, and I'm here to give you a compliment. My sister is a juvenile drug court judge in Marietta, Georgia. And she didn't actually, you know, she didn't come to me for her information on how to handle this thing, you know. She has spent many, many hours and days and weeks traveling with you guys, being away from her family, being away from, you know, her the people that she's involved with. Her court happens on a Wednesday night, and I get some of the bad stories. I get some of the bullshit stories, and I also get a lot of the success stories, you know. And she, the thing that I'd like to say to you is that I appreciate it. I don't know that, I know there's some conflict there about it. That's not my business right now. My business is to give you a tremendous compliment and tell you how rewarding it is and what a great success it's been in her neighborhood. And thank you. Her name is Juanita Stedman. Yes, uh-huh. Yes. She's very good at, she's very good at getting them on their, you know, on their BS. And she asked her court reporter one day, she said, when I say, duh, how do you put that in the report? And they said, oh, we just leave that part out. Thank you very much.
I lived in Marietta for 30 years. It's improved greatly since I moved to Kentucky.
My name is Jeffrey. I'm an alcoholic. And I operate a first offender drinking driver program in San Francisco, in California. And surprisingly enough, there is no drug court yet in San Francisco, and they're just in the early stages of developing something like that. And I've been speaking with the director of the San Francisco DUI programs. And as a matter of fact, in San Francisco, you're not allowed to sentence any individual to Alcoholics Anonymous or any other 12-step meeting as part of a condition of probation. And one of the things that I think it's a disservice to people when you don't have an opportunity to expose them to some recovery. Because in Marin County, where I live, I was honored and privileged when a judge sentenced me to 7 meetings a week for 5 years. And
you know, I'm not going to feel so bad. I order people to do 30 and 30, 60 and 60, but that's like 2,100 and 2,100. That's a lot of meetings.
Yeah. When I was 6 years sober, I got to go back and go to the court and meet that judge and tell him. And actually, we had an interaction, and he told me that he's been following my progress, and he loved me, and he was proud of me. And that was my proudest moment. And so for all of you, I just want to honor you and thank you.
You know, before you ask this question, I was looking at the literature, the AA literature, and it says 12% of people who are involved in AA were court ordered. And whether that's pretty much an old stat. But if, in fact, you found your way into AA, and it was like the nudge, you got a nudge from the judge, I'm suggesting to you, because it really did change my life, go back and tell the judge thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go back and tell him that. Because, you know, tell her that, tell him that, go back and say, you know what, years ago, this is what you did. And I was lost, and it helped me. And I found my, you know, you shined a light in the path, and I had to walk down that path, but do that. Whoever helped you, but to let them know.
Thank you. My name's Lynn. I'm an alcoholic from Las Vegas. Hi. I'd love to go back to that judge, but I can't remember who it was. I think I was in a blackout when he told me. That was 21 years ago, and I had no idea. I'm the director of a women's recovery home in Las Vegas, and I love the work that you guys do in the drug court also. In Nevada, they have simultaneously, they have them go to Alcoholics Anonymous, but they also have them go to outpatient treatment. And the outpatient treatment's like a lot. It's 3 to 4 hours for each session. They have to pay for it, so they have to work to make that. And then trying to squeeze in their AA meetings. And it's really difficult for them. The outpatient rarely works. To me, it's not run by AA, so rarely works. Because we get a lot of clients in our center that have gone to only outpatient, and they come into us because Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned, is the only thing that works. But I would like to see the courts, the drug courts, at least in Nevada, lower the amount of the outpatient they have to do so they can spend more time in AA. The other thing I wanted to ask is there an education program where I've found, because I go to court with all the gals that come through my house when they have legal troubles because I'm a paralegal, is there an education program that we can disseminate information to the judges, CPS, public defenders? And because I've found that a lot of them do not know about not only where all the AA is or where all the recovery centers, it seems to me like Like there was one judge who said that go to your classes. They asked a defendant, what classes did you go to? Now, the defendant said, I didn't go to classes. Well, she'd been in AA for 3 years going to AA meetings. So I would love to see some type of education program where we can, you know, to educate all of the people that work with the sending the people to us. Okay? She wants to.
You're absolutely right. And one of the things that I was working on just this week is not only working to get the education of drug court judges raised or the awareness raised among drug court judges, but to raise awareness among all judges. Because, quite frankly, there are only 1,600 drug court judges, soon to be 2,000, and some of them are in the same court, so it's even less than that. But it's important that all judges understand the addiction to drugs and alcohol, and to understand their ability to really get folks to go in the right direction. But you raise a good point, so I just wanted to thank you for it.
Thank you. I'm available to work with you on that project if you like.
Her name is Karen, if you can remember that.
My name's Richard, and I'm an alcoholic from Warren, Michigan. Past couple of years, we've had a lot of informal discussions as to what to do with court-enforced, coerced people coming in, whether to sign their forms or not. And there are groups in the metropolitan area that will not sign any attendancy forms, and others will get their buddy next door and he's next to them, you know, please sign. And so there's really no uniform way of signing these. So a couple of ideas came up because of this, and one is, don't sentence people to closed meetings of AA because they may be very, very resentful being called alcoholics. Sentence them to open meetings because anybody can come to an open meeting. And maybe first offenders, get them to an open meeting for 3 months, and then if you see there's no progress, then send them to the closed meetings. But our third tradition is that the only requirement for membership is a desire to stay sober, not to be coerced into coming to AA. I've seen many people, especially women, who sit there, say nothing, and are very, very resentful that they have to come and sit there and listen.
Hi, I'm Emily. I'm an alcoholic from Anchorage, Alaska. And what I wanted to say was, how many people in this room were coerced into to going to AA meetings? Nobody in here was coerced? Okay. I was in a blackout back in 1982, and the judge told me I was a menace to society, and so I got to go sentenced to AA, and I got sentenced to do women's treatment, and I got sentenced to 100 hours community service, and this was back in 1982. And, today if I could find that judge, I would give her a hug. I was a .244, and I wasn't even drinking that night. I ended up with acute pancreatitis, and I was medevaced to Vail Hospital. But what I wanted to say was, I am such a strong supporter in the drug courts. In Anchorage, we have the Alaska Wellness Court. We have the Felony DWI Court. We have the Family Care Court. And we're losing our funding for some of it. And it's such a tragedy, because why throw somebody in a prison that if they had diabetes, you wouldn't throw them away? And it's like, we're responsible. If someone walks through that door and they're an alcoholic or an addict or whatever and their life is falling apart, we are responsible to reach out and talk to them. It's our responsibility to tell them, hey, put a buck in there. You drink coffee, put a buck in there. We are responsible. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. We're not there to just sit. If that person, when I walked through that door back in 1982, had not said, come back, we'll love you until you can love yourself, I would have been dead, And all I can say is we are responsible. These people are coming through the systems. They're trying to change their life. So it's our responsibility to put the hand out there and work with them. I'm tired of throwing people away that are an alcoholic. Yes, they need help. They have a disease. So it is our responsibility to work with them. And, more power to you. God bless you. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're talking about it. Educate the judges. Reach out. We need more drug courts. I worked 2 years inside of a prison in a therapeutic community. I saw miracles happen. We are all miracles in these rooms today. So just reach out. If you got a resentment about the newcomer coming through the door, maybe you better do an inventory and do a poor stuff.
Okay.
there's no joke out there, you know, working with our colleagues and trying to educate. There is some confusion from some judicial officers about therapeutic courts and specialty courts and drug courts, the mental health courts, you know, things like that. And there's a joke out there that says, how many judges does it take to change a light bulb? And the other judge says, change?
My name is Reed. I'm an alcoholic. Hi there. I'm from Seattle, Washington. I think my home group would probably shoot me if I didn't bring this issue up. I think that we're... By the way, it only takes one judge to change a light bulb, but the light bulb has to really want to change. I think we're really skating a little bit over the issue of affiliation. What's been happening a lot more in Seattle, and this probably the lack of education on the part of some judges, is that they are asking for full names, they're asking for phone numbers, and some of them are actually even calling to verify that people have been at these meetings that they say they've been at. This is direct affiliation of Alcoholics Anonymous with the courts, and that's not okay. I'm glad to hear that you do agree with me, and I would just encourage you to educate the people that you're working with. I suspect it's not drug courts, frankly. I think drug courts are specialized enough and are familiar enough with Alcoholics Anonymous that they would not do that. But it is very important that we, as a fellowship, also educate people through CPC that these sorts of things are not okay. If people come into my meeting, I will sign their slip, I will give them my first name, and that is all I will do. I cannot verify that they've been there, and if I sign their slip and they walk out 5 seconds later, that's none of my business. And I can't do anything more than that. So I just wanted to bring that issue up.
Thanks.
My name is Rudy, and I'm an alcoholic, grateful alcoholic. I'm from Downey, California, and I'm very grateful to be here, and thank you people for having sent me here on a court card. I'm 52 years old, I'm 19 years of sobriety, and if it hadn't been for that court card, I probably would have never gotten here. I was too much into my denial. And I'm grateful for that. Also grateful that it wasn't at a time before that when the judges were saying you either join the service or you go to jail. And I know that a lot of them that joined the service, no offense to the service, I was in the service myself, but it escalates in alcoholism. So for that, I'm very grateful that I was at the time, at the right time. Thank you.
Thank you.
George, I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to speak for just a second about the affiliation question. I think it is a AA responsibility to educate the courts, and we probably have a lot to do about our traditions. But I think with regard to the affiliation, it would be helpful if the courts retain their jurisdiction up to the time the person walked in the door of our meeting. And then what goes on at that meeting, that's our problem and how to deal with it. And when they leave, then they're back in your jurisdiction. Personally, I would hate to ever see somebody go to jail for not putting a dollar in the hat. And for two reasons. One, we have a tradition of voluntary self-support. The other is the fact that you know that the person didn't put the dollar in the hat meant that somebody was reporting what they were doing at that meeting, and that's an anonymity problem that is a very big concern.
The complaint was a generic complaint about people that I was sending there, yep. And so that's how it came in, not an individual,
right.
And my generic threat was a generic threat to everybody.
Yeah. But I understand the generic nature of it. But implied in that was that you had some way of finding out what they were doing at those meetings and were ready to act on it. Okay, thank you.
Our last presenter.
Thank you. My name is Dick. Dick T. I'm from Zanesville, Ohio, and Northside Group. And I'll tell you what, on our side of the street, we're not going to get all complicated what you guys do, but thank you very much. I don't think we do have a drug court in our community. And what we do as a group, it's a group conscious thing. And if we decide that, we've been signing court slips forever. And when they don't have court slips, we have them made up for them. But, you know, when they get to walking past the podium and they want to go home to pick up their court slips, you know, and interrupting the speaker, we stop this. We put a quietus to this right now. We had a group conscience. We say, sign the slips. Stick them over there on that table. They can go out that door. They don't have to come this way. And it's not for us to say how long they stay. We're not your keepers. We have people going to the juvenile facilities in our city, the city jail, the county jail, and we take literature in, and they're more than welcome to come to our home group if they would want to after they get through serving their days in jail and what have you. And we don't have any problem with that. And then we had another issue about, okay, mental health is sending a lot of people to us. And we're sitting there scratching our head. Well, what do we do with this one? Now, you can't be asking, what? You don't have a gun charge, do you, or this and that, or whatever. We just signed the damn slips and put them out there. Go on. And just maybe one person might come back and get sober a day at a time and stop going to jail. You know, take care of their families or whatever it is. Just one. Your odds are probably worse than that. Thank you, Drew. Thank you.
I was wrong.
Thank you. I'm Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. From Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I happen to be asked to be the director of the CPC committee this current year. And I, you know, just briefly, I just want to say, if AA has taught me nothing else, it's to be part of the solution and not part of a problem. And, you know, I just thank you all. I can't tell you how much I thank everyone. And it's given me new ideas about what to take back to my committee, to new areas we can work on, the drug court folks. I mean, I'm just learning so much just from this one session. And just, of course, encourage others to do the same. And, you know, it is about communication and education, all to help the suffering alcoholic. You know, that's our primary purpose. So I thank you for helping us. That's all.
Thank you. I would like to close with a serenity prayer, but before we do that, I would like to thank our presenters. And I would like to thank you. You've been wonderful. You can give yourself an applause.